I'd like to welcome you all this morning to Washington, D.C., and the 43rd Annual Association for Recorded Sound Collections Conference. We're delighted to be here, and it looks like we're going to have a record attendance at the conference again, so we're very excited about that. In true ARSC tradition, we have some kind of a quirky little bit of business to take care of first. We open the business meeting before the conference, adjourn it, and then we reopen the business meeting again on Saturday. So we do have a little business to take care of first. As many of you know, this is an election year, and I hope you all sent in your ballots. And in accordance with the bylaws, Article 10, Section 5, Certification of Elections, we are required to elect 3 inspectors of elections so they can get right to work and start counting. Therefore, at this time, as president of the association, I call to order our 43rd annual meeting for the express purposes of electing the inspectors of elections. In Article 9, Section 3 of the bylaws, it states that 1/3 of the total number of members in good standing in attendance at the meeting shall constitute a quorum for transaction of business. Considering the size of the crowd in this room, I declare that we have a quorum. See, I told you this was weird. Nominees must be members who are neither candidates for nor holders of offices to be filled. I will entertain nominations to the floor. We need 3 inspectors of elections. Can I get volunteers for the inspectors of elections? Raise your hand if you would like to be. Jerry Fabris, thank you. Dick Spotswood, thank you. And
my name is Bruce Epperson.
Bruce Epperson. Do we have a Peter Schambarger is writing those down. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Dick. We'll need another one. Can we get a third inspector of elections? This is a very short task that takes place sometime between now and Saturday. Can I get a hand for a third volunteer? Great. Sorry, what's your name?
Jamie Madden.
Thank you very much. I met you last night. Does somebody move that the nominations are closed?
So moved.
Can we get a second?
Second.
Thank you. That was Franz Janssen seconding. All in favor of closing nominations, say aye.
Aye.
Against? Great. The ayes have it. The nominations are closed. Do I hear a motion to elect?
Moved.
All right. We had a motion over there. Peter, you got that? Who moved?
Mark.
Great. Thank you. Do we have a second? We have a second back in the back. All in favor?
Aye.
Against? They are elected. Do I have a motion to recess?
I move.
Mike Beal moves. Do we have a second to recess this meeting until Saturday?
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Great. Thank you very much. Now we're through the quirky ARSC part of the meeting. Our meeting is now the business meeting is now recessed until Saturday, May 30th, 2009, at 4:15 p.m. So thank you again for all attending. We have a very busy schedule this morning, and I'd like to jump right into that, but I do have a couple of announcements first. My first announcement is that banquet tickets are still available, and if you'd like to attend the banquet, you need to purchase that banquet ticket by the end of the coffee break. I'd like to thank briefly some of the people that organized and sponsored the conference. First, our program committee, who put together the program for the next 3 days, chaired by our second vice president, David Giovannoni, Patrick Feaster, Roberta Freund-Schwartz, Hannah Summers, and Seth Winter. So thank you very much for the work you've done. We had a record number of proposals this year, and it's a difficult decision of which ones get to be accepted and which one don't, and they did a marvelous job of putting together a program. I'd like to thank the people that offered tours to ARSC members yesterday, including various divisions of the Library of Congress, the National Archives and Record Administration, University of Maryland, National Public Radio, and Smithsonian Folkways. So thank you to them for opening their archives to our members. And thanks to our sponsors of this this conference today. We have the Audio Archive, Eric Jacobs, CubeTech, Knox Vintage Records, Prism Sound, BMS Chase, Hollinger Metal Edge, McFarland, Millennium Media, and Music Systems. And many of them are exhibiting next door, so please do thank the sponsors for supporting this conference. It's not possible to put on these conferences without them, so we appreciate their... Oh, I'm sorry, it's three more. It's Hawthorne's Antique Audio, Hollywood Vaults, and Smithsonian Folkways. So do thank those sponsors when you see them. And last but not least, we have members of the Local Arrangements Committee, including the chairs Karen Fishman and Nancy Seeger, as well as their eager assistants Sam Berlosky, Margaret Erschler, and then conference manager Brenda Nelson-Strauss, registrar Nathan Georgitis, audiovisual supervisor Adrian Cosentini, and outreach Anna Maria Manuel, and webmaster Brian Cornell. So I want to thank them all. As many of you know... as many of you know, ARSC is an all-volunteer organization, and it's not possible to do these without people having a sense of community service and public spirit in order to make this organization function and run and put on these conferences every year, as well as putting together the journal, the newsletter, and things like that. So if you have any interest in becoming further involved, I know we have about 15 first-time attendees and a lot of new members here today. If you have any interest in becoming more involved in ARSC and contributing to this this field, please see me or committee chairs, anybody, and talk to them at some point during the meeting. We'd be love to have you help out with ARSC. And one last thing, we have, through the generosity of the Savada family, Eli Savada, whose father, Mort Savada, was a longtime member of ARSC. They have provided travel grants for students and first-time attendees this year, and we are delighted that the Savada family has chosen to provide these subventions. And we have given subventions to three people, Dan Scheinman and Jeff Willard from the University of Texas at Austin. If you want to just stick up your hand and wave that. And last, we have Ashley Conway, the music librarian for audio and digital services at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. Great. I'd like to say on behalf of the association that we're delighted to have you here. It's great to have new members here, and we know that attending professional conferences can be expensive. And thank you again to the Savada family for providing these subventions. And without further ado, because you'd rather listen to our experts on copyright this morning than me, let's move right ahead with that. And I'm just going to turn it directly over to Tim Brooks. Most of you know Tim Brooks, who has been a longtime member of ARSC, former president of ARSC, and is now the chair of our Copyright and Fair Use Committee. And he has assembled a panel on copyright reform in 2009 and what we can expect. So thank you very much, Tim, and welcome.
Well, thanks. And we'll try to make a session on copyright interesting to you this morning, if we can, lively, if nothing else. First, I'm going to give you some information, bring you up to date on what's been going on, some exciting developments, I think, in the last year. And then we're going to have our all-star panel of people who you may not have heard from before within ARSC. Some people who have been very actively working in the field of copyright, know Washington, know some of the law about it, and can tell us some of the realities of what's going on out there, what's possible out there. So that's to come. But first, less room up here than I expected. I'd like to take you on a little journey, if you'll just bear with me a little bit here. I'd like to take you on a little journey and kind of imagine a world where the following things are true in America. I'm going to put some of this on the floor. Okay, now we can go on our journey. What if, for example, there were thousands of private CD reissues of recordings made before 1940 freely available from institutions that could put them out if they wanted to, from organizations, scholarly organizations that cared about that sort of thing, like ARSC, for example, from private individuals. Why? Because all recordings in America made before a given year, let's say 1940 as a year, were in the public domain. Why 1940? Well, 1940 is 70 years back. That's a pretty long time. There's not much economic value of records that are older than that. We know that from many economic studies and experiences in other countries. So for the purposes of our little journey, we've got to pick a date. Let's say 1940. What would happen? People could put out reissues of that stuff without seeking anyone's permission or paying anyone. What would happen as a result? Well, you'd get a lot of reissues. Reissues like these, for example. These CDs are filled with American recordings, actually. They're all issued in various foreign countries. They're all perfectly legal there because these recordings were made before 1940, in fact, for their laws, before the 50s. And you would get recordings from private individuals. Some of them, like the one on the bottom right there, is from a phonograph society in London. And they're all quite legal, even though they're American recordings, because in those countries, those recordings are all in the public domain. And it wouldn't stop there. There would be hundreds of such recordings issued. And, in fact, there have been where this, in fact, is the case. So first stop on our little journey. Let's say we pick a date, and that's true in America. You would have this kind of explosion, presumably, in America as well. Second stop on our little journey. What if we had websites? Thousands of them. Websites from institutions, which love to put up such ways for people to access their collections. Websites from private individuals who like to put them up. Websites from, again, organizations. ARSC has a website, of course, that could put anything they wanted up there, not only for streaming, but for downloading. You could download it with the click of a mouse and have pretty much anything you wanted to listen to or study or discuss in your class or anything else prior to 1940, because that would be the bright line, and keep it legally. Could there be such things? Well, on the left-hand side is one such site that operates out of Canada. Some of you may know about it, called the Virtual Gramophone. It's been up for more than 10 years now. There are hundreds, probably thousands, of recordings, many of them American recordings, actually, that are on that site. Mostly reflecting Canadiana, of course, because it's run by the Libraries and Archives Canada. The one on the right is European Archive, which is a public organization-run site, which is more recent, which is doing similar kinds of work in Europe because, again, all of those recordings are in the public domain in Europe. You probably can't read this because it's kind of small print up here, but the European Archive actually has three headings on it, those three kind of bluish bars you see there. One of them is for movies, one is for, on the left, one on the middle is for recordings, and one on the right is for web resources. Under the middle one, which is the recordings heading, if you go to this site from here, from this room or from this country, you'll get a little message, which I got, which you see down there, which reads, quote, due to copyright issues, the items in this category cannot be displayed in your jurisdiction, unquote. But if you go there from Canada or Europe or Myanmar or any place else, you'll get the recordings. Maybe not China, I don't know. Okay, what if? A couple more stops on our little journey. What if there were clear rules about what was and what was not under copyright? So a librarian, an archivist, or anybody would know where the bright line was. What if archives were free to preserve and circulate anything recorded before that bright line, anything at all? Not only preserve it, but circulate it and make use of it. What if, last one, you could even make available recordings that were still under copyright but had been out of print for many years, providing you paid a fixed fee to the copyright owner, a compulsory license, in other words. What if? Well, I know you're saying, what do you have for breakfast, Brooks? What have you been smoking, right? Actually, almost everything that I've just shown you, as I've kind of hinted, is true everywhere except here. Every country in the world has a public domain for recordings, except here. maybe not that last one on the list, the compulsory license. That's not true in most countries. But all of the others are. And as you've seen by some of those examples, the CDs, the websites, and so forth, they're being used, too. Miraculously, without any discernible harm to the copyright owners in those countries. But not here. It's illegal in America. So why is that true? Well, a little stroll down memory lane for legal scholars here. I'll try to keep it brief. In 1976, there was a major overhaul of copyright. Before that, recordings had not been under federal law in the U.S. at all. The 1976 Act brought them under federal copyright for the first time, effective as of 1972. You know, the laws never line up very well, but the laws passed in 76, effective as of 72. And when that law was about to pass, the last thing that happens after the Senate passes a bill and the House passes a bill, it goes to conference committee. And the conference committee works out the differences between the two bills so that the same bill can be passed by both houses. And often that's a matter of technical alignment of the way the wording is in the two. Sometimes it's more substantial, but usually it's like working out the details at the last minute so that you can get the thing to the president's desk. In this case, in 1976, when the bill was about to pass, and when it was in that conference committee, the Justice Department suddenly became concerned that the way the bills were written, that if they were passed as is, that recordings made before 1972, previously under state law, might all fall in the public domain all of a sudden, and therefore there would be problems with piracy and that sort of thing. So they sent a letter to the conference committee saying, you need to adjust this and take care of that possibility in the bill. So what the conference committee did behind closed doors was add a clause that said, all right, for the recordings made before 1972 to prevent that awful occurrence from possibly happening, we'll insert a clause that says that for transitional period, those recordings will stay under state law. So all the laws that apply and have applied for the past years will still apply for those laws. Eventually, they'll come under the federal regime like everything else post-1972. That sounded reasonable. How long is the transitional period? Well, we don't know. Let's make it the same period that we're giving as coverage for everything else, which at that time was 75 years. That seems a little long, but who knows? Behind closed doors, you can do lots of things. And the bill went through. And there was, as far as I can tell, and I'm certainly open to scholars who found anything differently, but as far as I can tell, this was never a subject of open debate. This was not a subject of hearings. Not a subject of inquiries by the government for interested parties. It was just done, stuck in, bill went through without much notice to that little provision of the bill. And as a matter of fact, for the next 30 years, there wasn't much attention to this. There were a few comments along the way, the copyright registrar saying, you know, we ought to do something about that, but neither she nor anyone else ever pushed it. And as a result, this little technical amendment, if I can call it that, to the Copyright Act endured for all of those years. In addition, there was no real knowledge of what that really meant. No one, you know, under state law, well, there are 50 different states. They all have different laws. There were no studies done. There's very little litigation history. So there's not much known, really, about what the practical effect of that was. And that endured for a long time, right through the 90s, when the next major overhaul of copyright took place, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and the acts of the Clinton era, where almost no attention was paid to this little quirk in the law, what happens to pre-72 recordings. That started to change, at least the knowledge of the situation started to change, only about 5 or 6 years ago, in part because of two very important studies done by a woman named June Besick, who you're going to hear from very shortly at Columbia, who has been studying state law as it affects pre-1972 recordings, both for published and unpublished, and began to take the curtain away and show us what those laws actually stood for in those states. And another study by Peter Yassi of American University, which is not yet out, but which has investigated a broad range of states as well. And in addition, there was And there have been several articles about it. Articles, one that came out recently, characterized this as quite possibly a, quote, thundering blunder by the Justice Department, an unnecessary addition, either totally unnecessary, that what they feared would not have happened, or something that could have been dealt with in many other ways, many less harmful ways. But since there was no real debate and no real examination of the issue at the time, which were not done, even someone as eminent as David Nimmer, one of the leading authorities on copyright, have said that, well, this was apparently a mistake that they made at the time. But we're living with that mistake. So for the next 30 years, as I said, not many people paid much attention to this. A few warnings, not heeded. And what ARSC has found in the last year, year and a half in Washington is that, in part, that's happened because there's been no advocate for historical recordings in Washington. Who would be such an advocate? Well, the library associations largely have other concerns. There are certainly advocates who have grown up that deal with the internet and internet access, but recordings, the kinds of things that ARSC is concerned about, have not had an advocate who has gotten on that issue and has made it an issue in Washington. And ARSC, I must say, and I blame myself for this, in part, has not been at the table. We did nothing throughout the 90s. Well, we worried about it at our conference. We wrung our hands, but we didn't really do anything. And so nothing has really been done about this since. What's the big issue? What has June and others found? Well, state law for pre-72 recordings were brought into stark relief by a case called Capitol versus Naxos that probably some of you have heard about, a New York State case in 2005. It's a very sweeping decision, at least in my opinion, that goes beyond the actual action that was brought and defines copyright in the state of New York as being absolute and perpetual. It's based on 17th century English common law. Not laws that were passed by the legislatures. And that's one thing we've found, that very few states have passed any laws that have to do with this issue. Therefore, judges have kind of made it up as they go along. It's legislating from the bench in the most classic sense. And that's not evil. That's what judges have to do when they don't have guidance from their legislatures and they have cases to decide. And they have generally sided with common law. Which is, and they go look back for precedents and what they can find in the past and try to deduce what seems reasonable to them. And the seven judges of the New York Court of Appeals, what seemed reasonable for them was whatever the industry asked them to do, which was give us everything. So that's what Capitol versus Naxos basically said. Now, you can say that's only New York, but in the internet age, what applies in one state can have enormous effect on other states. It certainly can have an effect on any internet operator who can't control where their stuff is downloaded, or maybe even know where it is. Naxos, the company, withdrew its historical reissues from the entire United States because it would be illegal in New York, one copy in New York. They could be subject to hundreds of thousands of dollars of fines. So Naxos brought this into sharp relief. The studies brought it into sharp relief. We found out it is common law. It is perpetual and absolute. It has no provisions for public domain, no provisions, or very few in these state laws, for anything like preservation or fair use or anything like that. And much of the preservation work that many of you guys are doing, actually, is technically illegal because of that. You can't make copies under common law, period, without permission, explicit permission. There have been very few lawsuits. I don't know any archives that have been raided or conferences, unless somebody bursts through the door here, that prevent us from playing a short part of their copyrighted recording made 100 years ago. Guard the doors there. I mean, maybe they'll come in. But what has happened is a climate of fear. What has happened, as you well know, at many institutions, the legal counsel... See, they are... They are after us here. How do I get rid of that? Click what? Well, it doesn't show it on my screen. That's a problem. There we go. Okay. There we go. Okay. So the common advice you get is there's risk involved here, so best not to do it. The most conservative approach is often what corporate attorneys, institutional attorneys will tell you to do. The other approach, which is risk assessment, some institutions have done that, but it's difficult to convince lawyers to advise you to do something that, you know, under the law as they read it, is illegal to do. And you probably won't get sued, but how do you measure probably? Especially when the consequences, if you do, can be towering under the penalties written into our laws these days. So what you've had is this climate of fear. What you've had is something that has come to be known as dark archives. The records could go in, they can't come out. What's the result in terms of availability? Well, this is the study that Steve Smolian and I did for the Library of Congress a few years ago, 2005, on what, in fact, is available from rights holders. Down along the bottom there, if you can't read it, is by five-year period, starting in 1890 all the way up to 1960 to 65. And that's the percentage of fairly significant recordings, recordings that are memorialized in discographies and the National Recording Register, that are available from the people who own them, the rights holders, because remember, in this country, everything is owned by somebody. From the most recent periods we looked at, the 60s, it's about a third, but it drops off very quickly from that point. On average, for pre-1965, the whole span, it's about 14% available. From pre-1955, which is where the Europeans are more or less right now, it's about 10%. From pre-1940, that year I threw out a little while ago, it's 6% available from the rights holders, 94% not available from the rights holders. So they're not selling the old stuff. They're not making it available. And it's perfectly logical they wouldn't, actually, because there's not much money in it. Right? We kind of know this intuitively, but until this study, there had never been quantification of that. This has made a difference to legislators and others who have seen it, because you can hold up exceptions all day long if you want to. Hey, we put out the Grand Opera series, so everything's okay. Let us keep everything. Well, you know, that's one of, what, 2%? They own it. They won't release it. They won't let anybody else release it under practical terms either. So when it comes right down to it, in the United States, things are pretty rotten when it comes to recordings. What are we going to do? Well, for a long time, many people, including many lawyers, and there are many lawyers in the room, so I'm not criticizing lawyers as a group, but have logically told us, you can't do anything. That's the way it is. Politicians, or people who said they knew politics, told us that, too. Perhaps you remember that in the 1990s, there was a column in the Ars Journal where readers could write in their questions, and they would be answered by an attorney. We had agreed with an attorney someplace in upstate New York to answer these questions. And the attorney, as I recall that column, almost always had the same answer, whatever the question was. No. No, you can't. But maybe that's not the only answer. A lot has changed just in the last few years. And I've got some news which I'll share with you in a moment about one of the big breakthroughs on that. But I want to give you a little timeline. What has gone on? Because some of this has been your dues money that is paid for this. In 2005, the Ars Board approved the first statement in its history, by the way, on copyright. We talked about it, we'd wrangled about it, we'd, you know, grumbled about it, we'd held our heads about it, but we never actually put anything down in writing about it. Well, we did in 2005. And it was a statement you see up there as part of the statement. Several provisions of U.S. copyright law impede the preservation of historic recordings, unduly restrict public access. Following that statement, the Copyright Committee took that charge and developed five specific recommendations for changes in the law that would address these issues. We also addressed the issue of whether Ars could do anything about it. Could we lobby? Could we go to Congress? There was a lot of fear in this organization, I can tell you, in the 80s and the 90s, that nonprofits can't lobby. You know, we'll lose our nonprofit status. A lot of urban myth around that. It is not true, I will tell you. You read the tax code, you read the laws, read Title 26. There are very specific standards that you have to go by, but it is perfectly legal. And in fact, many people say, as a social matter, it's very desirable because we're the kind of organization that should be giving input to Congress. So we resolved that. In late 2007, I interviewed Representative Rick Boucher, Democrat of Virginia, Why? Because he is known in Congress as an authority on copyright. Other congressmen turn to him for that. He's also known as an advocate of public, of the public in copyright. He's one of the good guys, so to speak. Therefore, he doesn't get much of his legislation passed in this area. but he's sympathetic to public access within reason, and he knows the law. The interview was published in the Ars Newsletter in 07. Boucher, the expert, was surprised by this. Really? Pre-72 recordings aren't available? That's something I hadn't focused on. So even in Congress, it looked like they weren't really aware of this. In 2000... Oh, let me stop for a minute. What were the five recommendations? First of all, place all pre-72 recordings under federal law so that there's one set of law that deals with all recordings in the U.S. and you don't have this proliferation of state laws and common laws and judges' decisions where you have no idea what's going on. Also, any change you make today has no effect on anything prior to 72 because they're not under federal law. So, first thing, before anything else, you've got to get recordings under federal law, so you've got one place and you can deal with that. The second is to harmonize the terms. That's a nice way of saying reduce the term from 95 years. There will be some objection to that, I'm sure. In the 1990s, when the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was passed and a lot of the extensions were done, it was done on the premise of harmonizing with other countries. That was the mantra in Congress. We've got to do this because we've got to be in line with copyright around the world. Unfortunately, the one thing they didn't harmonize, obviously, was recording. So we're kind of using their own argument against them on that. And there are many reasons why that should be done. I'll get to that later. Legalize the use of orphan recordings, recordings for whom no owner can be located, which seems like a no-brainer, but isn't. Fourth, permit the use of abandoned recordings, recordings for which the owner is known, but the owner hasn't made it available in very long periods of time, like a century, perhaps, with payment to the owner. And finally, permit best practices in preservation. Again, a seeming no-brainer to allow archives to do their work in the digital age. Okay, what did we do in 2008? ARSC hired a representative in Washington, a company called Malcolm and Wexler and Walker, represented by a young lawyer by the name of Malcolm Grace, who I think is in the audience somewhere. Malcolm, you're in back there. And I want to give enormous credit to Malcolm for spearheading this. You'll hear a little bit from him later on the panel. Malcolm, who has many connections on Capitol Hill, was the one that helped set up the meetings we had with more than 20 members of Congress, their staffs, and to take this to Congress to see basically what kind of reaction we would get. We had meetings with more than 20 key members of Congress who are involved in copyright matters specifically. We also met with the Register of Copyright, Mary Beth Peters, who's a very important player in this. We met with the dreaded RIAA, the Record Industry Association of America, representing the rights holders three times. We obtained support. This took some work to get through various bureaucracies, but we got support for our positions from six major organizations, including the American Library Association, which is a big player in this in Washington with a lobbying office and everything. More than 70,000 people represented by those various organizations. We prepared an amendment with Malcolm's help to be attached to a bill that was then being considered, the Orphan Works Bill, that would direct the Copyright Office to open an official study of this issue of bringing pre-72 recordings under federal law, and lined up, Malcolm did, Democratic and Republican co-sponsors. So it was a bipartisan bill. This is not, by the way, a partisan issue. This is not Democrat or Republican, believe me. They both have voted for all of these extensions, and they both seem to be open to possibly remedying the situation. So that's what we did in 2008, pretty busy year. In 2009, with the generous support of you, the ARSC members, for some of these efforts. And it does take some money for travel and administrative kind of stuff to do this in Washington. The board authorized a coalition, should be formed, that is called now called the Historic Recording Coalition for Access and Preservation, the awkwardly named HRCAP. But, you know, with an organization like ARSC, I mean, who's going to argue about acronyms? Which can also help with the funding, the Music Library Association and the Society for American Music, to whom I give enormous credit, have both joined that coalition, and we're looking for other members. And here I'd certainly give credit to Gordon Thiel and Jerry McBride, ARSC members, who are also members of the MLA, for helping shepherd that through that organization, and Tom Reese, who's the president of the Society for American Music, for taking up the cause in his organization. Is Gordon here? Jerry, I know, is here. Thank you very much for that. Have gotten us support there. We set up a website early this year called recordingcopyright.org, which you'll see a little bit more about later. But there are also setbacks, as there always are in these things. The biggest being that the bill that we were trying to attach this amendment to, the Orphan Works Bill, stalled for a whole lot of political reasons in 2008, most of which didn't have anything to do with Orphan Works, by the way. It had to do with other politics, which you may remember were going on in Washington last year. So the bill stalled, therefore there was nothing to attach the amendment to, and so the amendment was died as well. So we started again from scratch this year. We looked for other ways to get our amendment or our study done, and drum roll here. I like these effects. I won't hit you with too many of them. Through connections with the Appropriations Committee, we got the wording attached to the Omnibus Appropriations Bill that was signed by President Obama in March. You've heard of those earmarks, those dreaded earmarks that keep getting stuffed into bills that go through Congress. Well, this was a good earmark. So an earmark that doesn't cost the government or the taxpayers a cent, actually. But it's an earmark that says that the Copyright Office has to study this issue. And I want to give credit here to Dick Spotswood, who led us to a very fine and socially conscious musician by the name of Stephen Wade, who used his connections to help us get through to the Appropriations Committee, without whom none of this would have been possible. So Stephen and Dick, wherever you are in here. We all owe a great deal to them for helping make this happen. The wording of this directs, and it's the ARSC wording, directs the Copyright Office to look at the effect on preservation of federal coverage of pre-72s, to look at public access, very important, to pre-72s, and to look at the economic impact that this would have on present rights holders if pre-72s were brought under federal coverage. In fact, almost as you see, nothing is available of early, so the economic impact presumably is not going to be enormous, but they will look at that, in fairness. What happens now? Well, the Copyright Office has to take public comment. They have to report back to Congress in 2 years on their findings. This is exactly the way Orphan Works was handled a few years ago. And for the first time, this is going to shed light on a very dark corner of copyright law that has been under the covers for years and years and years and has been doing increasing damage in recent years. Finally, not just ARSC off there in the corners barking at Congress, but the government itself is committed to a formal study of this issue where all stakeholders will have a place at the table. And I think this opens the door for a lot that ARSC wants to do. There are no guarantees. There's going to be pushback, I'll tell you right now. There are going to be people who are going to try to stop this. So we're going to have to make our case. Well, what kind of pushback can we expect to get? One is simply inertia. It takes a long time to get things done in Washington, I'll tell you that. Many things, even the Orphan Works Bill, which seems like a pretty obvious thing. If you can't find any owner, why should you be prevented from using it? 3 years that's been debated. Things just move slowly here. There are many people and organizations, stakeholders, that have other agendas. I mean, they're not against yours, but there are other things they want to get done, and yours is going to slow theirs down, so get out of the way. And there's fear. There has been fierce, sometimes irrational, opposition to the Orphan Works Bill. As I mentioned, 3 years, there have been hearings on this. There's been plenty of time for public comment. The bill has been changed numerous times to try to offer protections to creative artists. But after 3 years of negotiation, you go on the web and you type in Orphan Works Bill, you'll find things like, in capital letters, 1 million people against Orphan Works, a threat to the intellectual property rights, privacy, and free speech of Americans. It's an inalienable right to have copyright for eternity. You saw it on the web. It's true. And my personal favorite, license to steal. Those short phrases are very effective. There's a lot of this, and it's organized. It's not just cranks on the internet. There's 10 major music groups that have proposed this. The fabric designers have come out with guns blazing, saying our designs of drapes. Any drapes up here? Apparently, there's copyright in drapes too, and they're dead set against this. It's a license to steal. Here's a cartoon that's been floating around the internet by Houston Chronicle cartoonist Nick Anderson. On the left, your copyright. On the right, your copyright if Congress passes the Orphan Works Bill. Flush down the drain. Get ready. Fear is widely used to stop things in Washington, sometimes very effectively. But for all of that, the RIA is willing to talk. They were willing to support Orphan Works because they can see some value in it for them. They want to use some of that stuff too. And it's very important to talk to them. It's important to listen to their legitimate concerns. The industry is in bad shape. You know, revenues are down 41% since 2000. That's a big drop. You can say they were fat and happy, but boy, you take 41% out of anybody's revenues, like your revenues, for example, and that hurts. And Congress knows that. A lot of people have gotten laid off because of it. So you got to listen to them. You got to listen to their legitimate concerns. It doesn't mean we'll agree on everything. But you try to look in negotiation like this for a win-win, something where we get what we need for the public and they get what they need economically. And oddly enough, federal control of pre-72s, if done right, could be a big benefit for the record companies. They could get a lot of money out of this, not from Nora Bayes, not from Caruso. That's focusing on the wrong thing. They could get from, think of all those records from the 50s and the 60s. Which are not under federal law now. They won't get performance rights for those, which is a lot of money. They won't get streaming rights for those, which is a lot of money. There's where the real money is, where the Elvises and the early 60s stuff, the Beatles, all that. They can get a lot in protections. So there's the stuff in it for them if they're willing to give up Nora Bayes. What have we learned? Well, the first big aha was that, as I kind of alluded to before, no one knew about this issue. I won't say no one, but hardly anyone in Washington, certainly the people who mattered on Capitol Hill didn't know about it. There was a lot of congressional support. I would characterize, and you can see what Malcolm says about this, but I would characterize this as soft congressional support. It seemed like a reasonable ask. We were perceived as nonpartisan for the public good, not harmful to stakeholders in what we were asking for, were the white hats, effectively. The House, we learned, is where IP legislation matters. You think they're two co-equal branches, but in fact, the House drives the train on IP. There are specific congressmen who matter much more than others, particularly the chairman of the committees. You need to get to them. We need to talk to the stakeholders, the RIA and the record companies. We need, whether we agree with them or not, Congress wants you to have talked amongst yourselves before you come to them to adjudicate. We can expect a fear campaign. Some of it will be irrational and you'll laugh at it, but boy, it can be effective when you've got a room full of musicians who say, what do you mean they're going to take away my copyright? License to steal, all that kind of stuff. It's going to take time. It's going to take persistence. It's going to take some money. Frowny face. But smiley face, we did learn that change, in fact, is possible in this area. Okay, what about these websites where you can learn more about this, and others can? Recordingcopyright.org, I hope you'll visit it. This is the home page of it on the internet. There's a petition just waiting there right now, just waiting for you to sign. Please go sign. There aren't many people signed up yet for. In Europe, when the companies tried to extend copyright from 50 to 95 years, a petition went up. There were 6,000 signatures in a week against it. And I think there's something like 12 or 13,000 against it now, because they're organized. They're organized. They got out the word, and people, and I've noticed, by the way, the signups for this petition so far, more of them have been from non-ARSC members, or at least people I don't recognize, than from ARSC members. So come on, get out there. And there are lots of other things, like frequently asked questions about this issue, including what the arguments against it are, and a recording timeline of what we thought were important recordings that are unavailable because of the law. Maybe you'll have some suggestions for others that could be added to that. We'd like your feedback on this. So please visit it. Let us know what you think. In conclusion, then, because I want to get to the panel, the big information here is the laws are being rewritten now. It's a digital age. There's a lot going on in copyright. The door, as I see it, has been kicked ajar on this. The study is a huge breakthrough. This brings the light to this issue for the first time. It's not a slam dunk. Could end disastrously. I mean, it could be like overrun. But we think the Copyright Office is sympathetic to what we're trying to do, and we think they'll be fair in representing the positions. And we think we might even get some of our supposed opposition to this to go along with this if they see something in it for them. So we got to be persistent, but we think with your support, and we may ask for your support in letters to congressmen or something when this comes up to to a vote, but we think we can make a difference. So that's where we are right now. And with that...